Good morning, everyone. My name is Brian Maroney. I'm a bridge engineer. I currently work for the California Department of Transportation. I'm Tony Anziano's deputy. I'm his bridge engineer. Tony, of course, is the program manager for the toll bridge program, so we work on like Antioch and Dunbarton and including the Bay Bridge.
Actually, Brian, can you spell your name, and then we're going to go down and get Marwan and Mazen as well.
Okay. B-R-I-A-N-M-A-R-O-N-U-Y. And then together we work and report to the Toll Bridge Program Oversight Committee, which is the group that was out there today. Today what I'd like to do is go over a little bit about the retrofit that we've designed. And I've got probably about, what do you think, about 300 technical people working in our pyramid. I've chosen two of those people to bring with me. I always like to have teams. I don't like to work by myself. And I wanted to bring two people that I thought were important. This is Dr. Marwan Nadir. He's the lead designer for the self-anchored suspension bridge, an incredible engineer. He's also vice president of T.Y. Lin International. He's a bridge designer. And then I've also brought Dr. Mazen Wahbi with me. He is one of our leads on the material testing. So things like a piece of steel, piece of concrete, piece of timber, et cetera. We turn to Dr. Wahbi and his crew to help us evaluate and get recommendations from design in design as well as out in construction. Is that material okay? And he's just got a bag full of all kinds of equipment and tools and knowledge to help us guide those things. So if that's okay.
Actually, can you have Marwan and Mazen both spell their names?
Okay, good morning. My name is Marwan Nader, M-A-R-W-A-N, last name N-A-D-E-R.
My name is Mazen Wahbi, M-A-Z-E-N, last name Wahbi, W-A-H-B-E-H.
Can you specify what type of engineers you are?
Myself, I'm a structural engineer. I earned my bachelor's in civil engineering and my master's in structural engineering and my PhD in earthquake and structural engineering.
I'm a bridge engineer. I specialize in basically structural mechanics and earthquake engineering. I got my doctorate at University of California, Davis, in that area.
So Brian, if you want to start.
What kind of engineer is
he? I'm a materials engineer. I've earned my PhD down at USC.
And again, as Brian moves to both sides of the room, if we need to pause so everyone can realign themselves, we will do that.
Can you move the model right front? Have to do it there.
There's a lot of material on both sides.
We could try to pick things up and bring them over. They're all light enough to pick up, except for the anchorage. We're not picking that up. Whatever you think, Andrew.
Okay, if you can do it easily, then that's fine.
Okay, so Mazen, you can probably pick up everything, right?
It works best for your presentation, right?
Okay. Well, then let's go ahead and grab this one. Could you help me, please? Thank you, Mazen. Yeah, just stick it right in the middle or any place.
Oh, watch, Tony.
Any place, yeah.
I think if we just put it here, we get just...
And again, we're going to save questions for after the presentation.
Okay, what I'd like to do is start with a little bit of focus here. What I like to do in design is I like to ask folks like Ade Akinsanya and Marwan, when we're working on something unusual, what I like to do is find very simple models. It's great to have computer programs, drawings, et cetera, but sometimes just to verify constructability, verify everybody's on the same page, and we have large, complex teams on this job. It's never just one person or two people. I like to do these kinds of things, and this design firm has been really great for doing this kind of thing. It's just a simple foam board model, and we have different colors here, and the bridge is not going to be this color, but what we've got here is a very simple model of the top of Pier E2. So superstructure is up here. There's a box girder bridge over here, self-anchored suspension bridge, orthotropic box. There's another one here. These are the columns. Obviously, the columns are much, much, much larger. This is on the order of about 75 meters. That's over 200 feet in the real world. This is a metric job. Okay, so a box sits over here. The orange elements here, those are the bearings. And Dr. Nadir and others and his team, they've designed these. And bearings are really, really tricky things. On a bridge, in my experience, the two hardest things to design and maintain on a bridge are bearings and deck joints. Now, what's tricky about a bearing is it's a bottleneck of tremendous stresses. Imagine a bridge 25 meters across. I think on the order, that's like 75 feet with its self weight and all kinds of structures, trucks, etc. Now, all of that weight has to funnel right down through these two bearings. And bearings, not only do they have to carry tremendous concentrated load, they also have to allow for movement. You know, lots of times you want something big and strong and you don't want it to move. Here, bearings, they have to, and that's because bridges, when a big truck goes over it, it does flex. And when it gets hot, it expands. When it gets cold, it shrinks. Okay? So these bearings are designed to carry tremendous loads this way and vertical, but Dr. Dandier and his team have designed these to be able to rotate. So when there's a truck out here in my arm, and it goes down like this, it's allowed to rotate. So these are very complicated things, and they're very important to the bridge. They're, if you will, kind of sacred ground. Now the blue elements, and if there's an earthquake, if the ground starts to move, if you will, right, and there's translation, all the kinematic variables, displacement, velocity, acceleration, the ground starts to move around. That means this starts to move around. And the mass of the structure, there's tremendous load that gets transferred from this inertia of the superstructure down to this pier. These, we are designing these not to be damaged. The place, the structural fuse, is down here in this system. Okay? Now, we do not want these bearings compromised in that condition. So what Dr. Dainier and his team have done, they've designed the blue elements. These are shear keys. What they do is they lock the bridge and the pier together so it can't move relatively this way, the kind of things that could happen in an earthquake. So they protect these bearings. So those shear keys are important. Right? Now, these shear keys that are directly over the pier, this one and this one, this is where the bolts broke. That's the 2008 that commissioners were talking about. It's not going to work here. Okay. These are samples of the rods that broke. And Mazen, would you be so kind as to bring me the other three bolts? Okay. Now, I want you to notice something, and Steve Heminger and the commissioners, they were right on target. Look how large these are, okay? They're 3-inch in diameter. And some of the other rods, they might be of the same material, but imagine something like this, and at one point, it's almost liquid steel as it's manufactured. And then as it cools down, imagine something like this, near liquid, and it's cooling down, the outside cools first. And it hardens first, but the inside is not yet cool. And then the inside starts to cool, and what does it do when it cools? It shrinks. So it starts to work against the outside. And then sometimes there are outside cooling systems, like, for example, quench and tempered, that also adds to the outside can be different than the inside. Now, if you have a large diameter piece of rebar, and Mazen, if you'd be so kind, large diameter rebar, and I need the PT too. This is reinforcing steel, very common. Okay, this has the same kind of process going on, only it's not the same grade of steel. This steel is on the order of 150 KSI, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less. This stuff is on the order of 60 KSI, right? And the smaller diameter bar, the less cooling problems you have. Okay. Now, this is a big fastener. It's a threaded rod. It's really not a bolt, it's a fastener. These are some other bolts that we have on the bridge, just so you see. This is the one that clamps down the cable bands. These are the type that are in the towers.
Can you pull that up for a little bit longer? Just give us a second.
This is a tower. It's a sample of ones in the tower. We've got way over 100,000 of these in the tower. This one's a 325. This is kind of a very standard kind of bolt. And also, I want to highlight one thing. One of the differences between, one additional difference between a 490 and a rod like this, 54BD, this, when it's put in place, I've never seen anybody actually tighten these up to actually yield. Where a 490, by design, 99% of the time, as you tighten the nut, you actually yield the steel. You take it beyond its elastic level. So the clamping forces per load per cross-sectional area on a 490, it goes way past yield. So the clamping that a bolt does, okay, it's different depending on how you apply them, right? A rivet is a thermal clamping, and a bolt like this, it's using, everybody took physics, right? Remember the seven basic machines? This is one of the screws, right? And it's one of the basic machines, and it clamps everything together. So these things are actually used differently, okay? So I also want to highlight, I heard discussions about what is the process here. I want to share with you a little bit of that process. I took poor Dr. Nadir and Ade through a very difficult time the last few weeks. We basically started with Ade Marwan, what was it? We started out with like 9 different alternatives, or was
right.
it more? Right. And what we did is we advanced the designs from concept and kept advancing them. And these guys had multiple people working on each alternative, and we would remove them as a team. We thought it was not the best solution. And we were constantly turning to experts with material, turning to experts in constructability, et cetera. So I wanted to make sure that's kind of highlighted. This model, the purple here, this is the area where that was described. I think it was Andre Boutros who was describing that. And I'm going to ask Dr. Nadir to go through a little bit more of that. But I want to make sure you hear why this one was so efficient. Ade and Dr. Nadir found a way to put that clamping force. These are the bolts that are broken here and here. These are not. You can't replace them because the column's in the way. These you can get in and replace if we ever needed to, right? But these you can't. So we have to have an additional design element, and that's this solution. Okay? Now, the alternative BD, it was like a collar that went around the outside and extended out. That extension, where we connected onto the pier, it had to reach out to areas where there's no internal elements of this pier that potentially could be damaged. Here, their retrofit puts that clamping right where it needs to be. It doesn't have to reach out. It goes right into the pier. And that clamping, if you will, it's kind of like, I love one of the commissioners said he was a farmer or a rancher. Those people always have a good sense of things. I don't really call this pre-stressing. I actually think of it as a tie down, and that's really what it's doing. Now, the elements that we're basically tying it down with is pre-stressing steel, and that's what this is. This is another kind of, I'm using the word incorrectly, but I think it's effective here, another type of fastener. And this kind of steel is not 60 KSI steel, 60,000 pounds per square inch steel, not 150, 160, sometimes even 170 KSI steel. This stuff is 270 KSI, so it's 270,000 pounds per square inch, so it's really, really strong. And basically what the design team has come up with, and of course there's a lot of this stuff, it basically goes through into the pier, wraps around, and there are many, many, many of these that comes down, and it hogs it down. And it creates enough friction to clamp these down, okay? So when two things are clamped together and there's a good normal force, they can't move relative to each other, okay? So that's really what they're trying to do here, clamping these things down. Now at the end, at the very bottom here, I want you to look over here, and Dr. Wabi and I are not going to be able to pick this up. But where that pre-stressing, that's the new connector we're going to use, the PT. This is what it looks like. Here's the same PT, only we'll have many, many of these. And this is the anchorage. And these will be actually not horizontal. These will actually be on the bottom. And there'll be many of these. So this is the new, if you will, anchor plate. And these are the pre-stressing strands, right? And there'll be many of them. And with that, what I'd like to do is, Marwan, would you be please so kind as to kind of walk them through what kind of analysis and what kind of design you've got going for us?
Thank you, Brian. Good morning. Like Brian mentioned, this is where the service loads, live loads, temperature loads, and earthquake loads gets transferred into the foundation. This is the east bend, as we call it, or the east pier, and 50% of the load of the bridge goes here. So these elements are not your standard elements. They are very, very special elements, and they require very large elements in every aspect of it, including the rods. The rods cannot be picked from your small bolts like these. This is what you envision when you talk about a bolt, not something that's this wide, 3-inch diameter, and that long. And like Brian showed you with a strand that you're working in, when you're looking at it and you have about 19 of those usually in one tendon, the actual anchorage is pretty much as big as a big pumpkin. So at the end of it, when we're designing these things and we're passing these large forces in the order of 10,000 kips that are going through these blue shear keys, what we do is we make sure that we design them with the extra safety that we need to, and the forces that need to be generated do not get anywhere close to yielding. And This element, like the bearing, as the bearing is deflecting that way, this element needs to be able to deflect that way. It needs to follow the same thing. Like the hinges of a door, the best way to think about it is these are all lined up in one line, and these elements carry the vertical load, and these elements are designed to carry the shear load, the transverse loads. Now, the shear key itself is comprised of two pieces, an upper housing, which is bolted to the box girder, and a lower housing, which is connected to the actual cab beam. Now, what you see here in red are the actual anchor rods, and those are the ones that were embedded into the concrete and failed. The way this is designed that it does not move relative to the cab beam. It will not move relative to the cab beam. And the anchor rods, they're doing two things. The first thing, they're clamping it down, and by clamping it down, like Brian said, friction alone would be such that it cannot be overcome, and therefore you can carry all the loads you can. Those bolts failed, and we need to put something instead of those. And to put something instead of those, we looked at two alternatives. And I want to stress and, quite frankly, make a point to let you guys know that what the team did, and the team is comprised of, you know, over 25 engineers and 25 people from the construction, from Caltrans, another 25 from the contractor. What they actually did in the last few weeks is usually something that takes months. These guys were working 24/7, and they should be commended to what they were able to achieve. And they looked at many alternatives. Like Brian said, we at one point looked at about a dozen alternatives, and we dwindled it down to the most two that we wanted. And the paramount thing with that is that it meets the same design performance that it was intended back in the day when we designed this thing. So what we did is we actually start with basic static equilibrium. We start with forces, and we start with resistance, and we look at all of that, and we work it so that on paper it works. We actually draw it up and make the calculations, and we finish up with that. And then after we do that, we actually, right now, we have the capability of going into finite element analysis, in which we actually do this modeling in very powerful software and actually look at all the stresses and the strains and the deflections to confirm that the actual design actually works. And we were able to confirm that. We did not want to come back to the commission here before today, before we know for sure that we did that. And when we do so, we also pass on that recommendation to Caltrans, and they do their own evaluation of this. And after they do that, they actually pass it on to the Seismic Safety Peer Review Panel, which does their own evaluation of that, and that's where we are today. We also have been working very hard with the contractor. So this has been kind of a format of American Bridge Floor as a contractor and T.Y. Lynn Caltrans as a designer. We're working in a design-build environment. What you see here is already something that the contractor has looked at, commented on, and said, yes, I can do this, and I feel more comfortable with this alternative than the other alternative so that I can has a better chance of meeting Labor Day. Now, what does this do here? What you have here is these two jackets that we have, and I'm going to try to remove one of them. This is what we're calling is the concrete jacket. It's actually a new concrete pour that we're actually pouring, and it actually builds out the cab beam. And by doing so, it allows us space where we can anchor these strands inside of them. And we actually build this, and we roughen the surface here so that this, for all practical purposes, is the same in one with the actual cab beam. And then we take that pre-stressed strands, and I want to go to the image here behind me. This is what's inside this element. Each one of these purple red elements that you see here is 19 of these strands, and they are going to be anchored at the very base with these anchor heads. And each one of these anchor heads you see in here is what you see over there that Brian pointed out to you, that big, large anchor head. And what this does, it does two things. The first thing, it pre-stresses it into the existing cab beam. It pushes it that way so that it holds it up. We actually have a lot of reinforcement that I don't show here, a lot of rebar, just like this, that's not shown here. And the other thing it does, it puts a forcing transversely like that, and obviously the red part is what Brian mentioned, is really the strapping down. And what this does is it applies the load exactly where the actual rods that failed, and we're not using them anymore, it applies the load exactly there. Thank you.
So I guess three things to remember. The material that Dr. Nadir and his crew are using, it's not just one material. It's what we call a composite. We combine three different types of materials, which is concrete. This is just a cross-section of it, and concrete is made up of several elements. Coarse aggregate, that's large rocks, say 3/4 of an inch to 1.5 inches. It's designed as you need. Then fine aggregate, types of sand, we test that. And then we mix up a concrete that has the right kind of fluidity that it can pour and flow down through the network of this system that Dr. Nadir has designed that includes lots and lots of reinforcing steel, large, tough, confining material, and that complex network of pre-stressing. So it's a complex material. Now, the next thing I want to do is I want to ask Mazen Wahbi to walk you through two very, very important things and anything else, Mazen, that you think is appropriate. But I particularly want you to see two things. I want you to see a hardness test. There are many different types. We just selected one type of hardness test. Hardness is something we're all going to hear about for a long time now. But I also wanted, there's another type of test, and we tried really, really hard to get one here, but it's about the size of a small car. Maybe next time we'll actually have it parked out front and you can actually watch it.
We have a video.
You have a video. That's right. And I want Mazen to show you something that we're stepping it up and we're implementing new, let's just say, types of technology that are not commonly used on regular jobs. It is an ASTM test. It's something that's been around for a long time, but we're stepping it up, and we're actually stepping it up in several ways. So, Mazen, would you particularly focus on that Sharpie, but also show them the hardness? And maybe you folks might even be able to try out the hardness test yourself.
Well, you've probably heard a lot in the past few weeks we're talking about hardness and toughness of material. And what I wanted to show is the difference between the two and how that's applicable to the material that we're dealing with the 354 BDs. The toughness is, it measures the energy that is required for the material to fracture, to break. So the tougher it is, the better the material is going to resist any cracking or crack propagations. Hardness is related to how hard or how much, you can say, energy is going to take to scratch the material. So we use different ASTMs, different methods to measure those things. And both of those work together when we're doing fracture analysis and failure analysis that you've been hearing about regarding those bolts. So the two areas we're concentrating on right now, we're doing all kind of other testing as well on the material to determine all the properties that we have for the material. The hardness, there are multiple ways that you can do it. You can actually take a sample just like this one and slice a piece. And we have one in the back, and actually, let me grab this. And here's a sample. And what you see here is, it's really, this is what it is. Just we took a slice from the material, and you see those dots throughout? These are indentations that we put in the material and measure how hard that material is. And it's also related to a scale. So when you're hearing numbers, you know, the 35, the 34, the 28, these are the numbers that we're talking about. And hardness on a material like this, like Dr. Moroni was talking about earlier, the way that's quenched and tempered, you would expect the hardness number to be higher at the surface compared to as you get to the middle, and then you get back up again to higher numbers. So you have a dip, and we have a figure there that shows how the hardness of the material dips as we go through. Now, this is done in a lab. You can also do it in the field, in situ, in the field. And that's part of what we're doing right now. We're going back and we are testing a lot of those bolts with in situ testing hardness. And so Majad there is going to demonstrate, he'll bring it here. And anybody welcome to come and do a hardness test. So we can use you on the field as well to come in and do some hardness.
Can we put it on top?
So you don't see it. This might need some.
Let's put it here. Can I put it here?
So what we do, you know, the first thing that you have to do with a equipment like this, and this is what we call the in-situ hardness. The first thing that we do is we calibrate to a known material. So we have a material that we know what the hardness is. It's a pure material. We use the equipment to calibrate on it, and we'll put. And you know, one thing it would be, you know, any in situ test is you have to repeat the same procedure, making sure you're using the right angle, the same pressure, etc. So you're getting repetitive numbers. So we'll calibrate and see what the numbers on this known hardness, and then we go to the actual sample itself, and we can take measurements every eighth of an inch to half an inch on the material itself, and that will give us a number. For example, like this one is 31. 32.6, 37. As you move it toward the end, you'll get different numbers. Anybody want to try? No? Okay.
What's the number supposed to be?
Well, the ASTM gives you a range between 31 to 39 for this material. So that's the hardness test. Now, the other test that Dr. Moroni was talking about is the Sharpie test. And that's what we call the toughness, is how much energy it's going to take for the material to break. And the way we do the test, we take samples again from imagine this is the rod. We machine it down, and we take a sample from the rod, machine it down to this size, and then we put a notch in the middle. And the reason we put a notch is we want to force the break to happen right within this area. And then we take the sample and temper it to different temperatures. In this case, we tested at 70 degrees and at 40 degrees. What you see here, we put the sample sometimes in liquid nitrogen, and that's to cool the sample quickly. And then you take the sample, I'm demonstrating like the guy, we put it in the jig at the bottom, and then you have the hammer that is pulled to a certain range all the way to the top. That's what Dr. Moroni was talking about. We wanted to get this machine here, but it was kind of a little bit difficult to get it. Once it's set at this known distance, the machine is zeroed, and then it's like a pendulum. It'll swing right through the specimen. And then what we're going to do is measure the rebound. How much energy did it take for the pendulum to swing up, and measure that energy that went into the samples to break it. And that gives us the toughness of this material. And there's a close-up there that you'll see as it goes through the sample. See how it went, and it fractures it, and this is what you end up with. Yeah, here you see how it breaks. So why is this important to us? It's important because we want the material to be tough enough, so if there is a crack, it's not going to propagate. The tougher the material is, the less fracture is going to propagate. And that's one thing we're looking at between the 2008s and all the other bolts that we are testing. And what we're finding is the 2010, for example, the values are much higher on toughness compared to the 2008.
So are you still doing these tests, these Sharpie
yes,
tests right now on the 2010?
Let's save questions, please, till after the presentation.
Okay, with that, I guess there's a couple more things I want to highlight.
There.
Mazen pointed out two different types of tests. One type of test that's not destructive. It's a non-destructive test. So I can ask Dr. Wabi and his team to go out. I want you to go out and do non-destructive testing out on that bridge everywhere. Okay. Now, in some cases, I've asked my boss, Tony Anziano, and we've asked the TBPOC, can we have financial support to actually do something, do some destructive testing, where we actually take some samples right out of the bridge, right? And we take them into a machine shop, cut them this way, and develop specimens that look like this. Cut them this way, sometimes in the middle, sometimes on the end, and we develop these kinds of tests, and we do this in the laboratory. Right now, I just want to make it very clear, I am getting great support in being able to do these kinds of tests. Some people say this is almost getting to research, but in situations like this, opinions are everywhere. And, you know, they're valuable, but test data, they're facts, and that's what I like to deal with. And as we make some of these decisions, what Tony and I and the rest of the team, BATA and CTC, what we're trying to do is pass up facts to the TBPOC so they can make the right decisions. And right now we're getting the support we need, and I really appreciate it. With that, Tony, if you or Andrew have anything to add?
Yeah, I think the guide goes through.
All right, I think we're going to go into Q&A. If you have a question, please raise your hand. Again, remember, this is being recorded. So state your name, your media outlet, to whom you are asking your question. And again, please keep your questions concise. We have about half an hour or so for Q&A. We want to give as many people an opportunity to ask a question as possible. Jason?
Can we move the structure first?
Oh, yeah. Let's move this.
I like that you called it structure. I'm going to tell the fine engineers that made it. Ashley, you're back here, right?
I took physics.
Yeah, it's Jason Biern from the AP. This question is for Brian. I just wanted to ask a quick question about the saddle replacement. And there's a concrete kind of wall or sheet that you're showing up here. And I'm wondering if that would impinge or get in the way of future repairs if there was a problem with this, because obviously the anchor rods in question were sunk into concrete or they're not accessible because of where they were put. And I'm wondering if putting concrete over these cables is a good idea if something happens and you need to get in there and replace one of them.
I understand. PT like this, it's not designed to be replaced. We have lots and lots of bridges all over the state of California. Frankly, they're all over the world. This whole technology was developed in France a long, long time ago. And what we do is, to make sure that the environment doesn't get in and corrode it, what we do is we put them in groups inside a duct. And actually, Andy, would you be so kind as to lift up? Andy's an old bridge engineer in construction, right? And what we do is we have ducts like this, and then there are many, many, I don't want to hit you. Many of these are in there, and then before we're done, we actually put a special high-strength grout that is environmentally very stable, and it actually protects these. With respect to the concrete is actually really important. We need it to spread out the load well. Imagine this steel. This is really, really strong steel. We use it all over California. We've had great success on all kinds of different bridges. But when you have such strength, and it's almost a point load, a concentrated load right at that anchor, we need it to distribute out. And what we do is we use that concrete and a network of reinforcing steel to do that. If we ever need to, we actually have many times lots of redesigns, like a widening of a bridge, or if we have a maintenance problem, sometimes we core all the time, and sometimes we chip away concrete. So we've had the ability to be able to get in with that concrete, but it does two very, very important things. It distributes that load, and then it also protects this. So we actually want it right there.
Tom Baker, Channel 2. You've got a 90-some bolts that you can't use. How many of these strands of pre-stressing steel will you be using to replace those 90 very large bolts?
Or just the vertical ones?
That's about 430 of those.
Can you guarantee that this will be as good or better than the original design to a fairly well?
It is, yes.
One other question. The purple things that are on the structure appear to be some sort of a steel collar or some sort of a steel container for all of this pre-stressed wire. What will it be made out of, and what will its function be? Relative to this whole thing? Is this just a place where all the forces will be concentrated?
It's a version of a saddle. It's made out of steel. It will be fabricated. The contractor is looking right now for which fabricator they wish to use. And it's a steel saddle. It looks different, but it's not that different than the kind of saddle you got on the top of a tower, but it's tailor-made for this location. So it's made out of steel, and it is, you're exactly right, it is the location where all those strands go through and transfer load, that clamping or hold-down force onto the shear keys.
Last question is this for me. This is an enormous structure by any standard. These are very large structures, and they are very large structures that have to be done very precisely in order to protect the bridge. Is there any way you can really get this done realistically by Labor Day or any time close to Labor Day, given both the enormity of the structure and given the fact that you can't screw this one up?
You ask a very good question, and I'm not going to I'm going to make sure I don't say something different than what my supervisors have said out there. But it's our job, and we've selected a contractor. It's our job to give us all, first, a very good, safe piece. And it was interesting that the commissioners, and I was so impressed with how they went right at that. And that has been our perspective from day one. We will not rush this. We'll work hard, and we'll put our shoulder into it. But we will not rush what we have to do. Now, given the design that we've got, and given the contractor that we have, the material types, the various types, and we were thinking about where do we get the steel, who's gonna make that saddle system that you described. That's the unique thing about this system. And the contractor we have, again, American Bridge Floor, and I think I know the subs they're gonna use, there's a probability that we can do this. But it will take, I've been through enough earthquakes, I've been through, unfortunately, things like this before. I think there is a chance, but, you know, things happen, and sometimes you have to, you know, slow down and redo it again, and sometimes that kind of thing happens. But there's a chance, and I think we've got a good team to do it. But again, I think the TVPOC was exactly right. There are no promises. This is going to require an unbelievable amount of hard work, and we need to get it right the first time.
Indulge me one more question.
Actually, Tom, we need to go to someone else. We can come back. Lisa?
Why was the design chosen to embed those 96 rods inside a place where you couldn't get them back out if they broke? Why was that design chosen?
Well, it's kind of interesting here is that everybody is focusing on that. There's in design, there's a lot of elements that are embedded in concrete. Every bridge that I've worked on has anchor rods that are actually embedded in the concrete. It's not the issue of the fact that they were embedded in concrete. The issue is that they broke. They did not perform the way they were expected to, and that's the issue at hand. Now, we have other rods on the bridge where we've provided access just because we can. And that's always a good thing to have, but that's not something that you, when you're designing, you put, if you think about it, the force is going to be resisted by the pier. So it's logical for you to take the force right above the pier and transfer it down. And if you look at those shear keys, right, they're right above the pier. If I put them away, it's just going to be that much harder to design the cab beam around it.
And Dan?
Yeah, I'd like to get a little... The slides were, at the presentation today, were a little unclear on the whole galvanization. In retrospect, A, was the decision to galvanize these bolts the right one? B, who decided to actually galvanize them? And C, am I correct that once they were prepared and galvanized, they were not tested before shipment, and given that you knew the potential problems with this process, why was it allowed to be shipped without the testing first, given the great significance and importance of this?
Want to take a shot of it? You want me to?
Take a shot, I'll follow you.
Okay, very good. You had like about four questions. So I'm going to do my best to remember them in order.
I'll walk you through them.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. The first one was, in hindsight, right? Well, of course, it's very easy for me now to Monday morning quarterback and go, well, you know, change it. But I guess it's important that galvanizing is one element of this. This is a certain type of these 2008s. It's a certain type of failure, those bolts. And that requires more than one thing to happen. You know how some things around your house or around wherever you work, it's not just a function of one thing? You know, sometimes life is a function of many things. Well, what it takes for these things to break the way they did, first of all, it takes a basic material. Not the coating, what's inside here and how it varies across it. And it's not just the material itself, it's how each little region within the material, how it all combines and how it interacts together. So there's the material first. Then there's the coating itself and the environment that's all around it, say if it's a hydrogen-rich environment. Okay? Then on top of that, it requires stress, so it requires all of those things to happen, kind of like a perfect storm. So there are places around the world where, the United States is not the only place that can put a satellite, into orbit. We're not the only ones who can go to the moon. There are other standards and techniques around the world where large diameter rods are galvanized. So the studies and the work that we're doing, we're looking into that, and there are differences of opinion, and that's why
I guess that goes to if you have to replace any of these, right? You have the 2010 bolts. This is still a ripe issue, right? Do you galvanize or don't galvanize, right?
Yes, and that's actually why we're doing the testing. That's one of the variables. What I'm trying to do is isolate the variables. With the testing program that we've developed and we're getting support for, I don't want to start varying the four major variables all at once, because then I won't know what variable is the one that's counting or which two combined to create that behavior. And clearly, it requires many things. So galvanization is one of those variables that we're looking at. Now, if obviously the 2008, 2010, right off the bat, they're differentiated, right? 2008 broke. All the other ones didn't. I'm also asking for support to do testing not only on 3-inch diameter, but also 2-inch, also 1-inch, because it is a variable. Now, I'm trying to conservatively grab all the variables, that is, go places where there's no indication there's a problem, all the way down to smaller diameters. We've never seen, the industry doesn't see these on smaller diameter rods like this, but I'm still going to be asking the METS folks to do testing on those, both in situ, non-destructive, as well as destructive. So galvanizing is one of the variables, size, material types, environments, as well as the stress level. Right? If there's no stress level, we haven't seen any of this before. So what we're trying to do is go through every single one of those. Monday morning quarterback, it's real easy to say, now let's use a different type of material, like the specifications with the replacement rods. I was allowed to take out a total of 8 2010 rods for destructive sampling. Now I have to put those back in. Well, the new ones that we're purchasing, we've added supplemental specifications on the material, and there's a reason for that. That means the material is not going to be as susceptible, all right? It's going to be a tougher material, and we're going to be replacing that. So that's one of the variables.
Will it still be galvanized?
Well, I'm going to try on those replacement ones. I'm actually looking to test some that are galvanized and some that are not, just to address that question, right? Because you go to Europe, and there are people galvanizing large diameter, high strength steel rods that are stressed up to 0.7. So I want to actually, on this job, I want to have hard test data. I don't want to have to guess. I don't want to have an opinion. Then we're also going to be varying the axial loads, and we're also going to be creating an acceleration chamber where we just put all kinds of basically salt. I mean, that's really what we're doing. And putting basically, decades and decades and decades of a nasty, nasty environment, and we accelerate that behavior in just a matter of weeks. So hindsight 2020, I'd change a whole lot of things, but I'm not so sure I would change that, because there are a lot of smart people around the world that say you can do it. Now, there are also some folks who say you shouldn't do it, but ASTM, the specifications, American Society for Testing and Materials, they have a warning in the specifications. And what we did is we put a team together, people who are specialists just in that area, and they gave us additional guidelines about, okay, given this, they got together and they thought about it and they said, okay, don't allow things like pickling, et cetera. So they did some extra things. But now I'm going back to address not only that question, but several others. And I don't want to give you an opinion. I want to give you a fact. And I want to get a test. So I think right now everybody
And how, what happened on the testing then on it?
Let's give someone else a shot here.
You knew you had a problem going in. What happened with the test? You know, how is it that you allowed them to leave and come out here without testing them, given you knew you were pushing
well, the test?
I'll go ahead and take that one because I've answered this one before. Tony Anziano, A-N-Z-I-A-N-O, State of California Department of Transportation, Holbridge Program.
Can you sit here?
Sure.
Thanks.
Real quickly, that's come up.
Another question.
Sure, that's come up before, and we've answered it. The issue you're talking about is the fact that our materials testing, our quality assurance testing for the 2008 rods did not occur until after the shipment was sent from the facility. Now, it's a contractor's choice. Typically, the contractor likes to know that we bought off on these things before the shipment because that costs money. In this case, they decided to go ahead and take that risk, bring them out to the site before our testing was complete. Our testing was completed before these rods were installed. The testing showed that these rods, the 2008 rods, met the specifications. So the testing was done.
Okay, next question for here.
I'm Jody Hernandez with NBC Bay Area. I'm wondering if you can tell us how many of these bolts are going to undergo the wet testing, and again, if you could explain that process in layman's terms, what are you going to be doing?
Right now, we're actually going to a meeting. We've started the process. We've started the design of it. And actually, right after this meeting, we're going to do it this morning. Now we're going to do it this afternoon. We're going to do enough of them to be able to be confident. You know, if you do one, you're never really sure. What we try to do is have a sample population that gives us enough confidence to be able to project it onto the full population. So it'll be some reasonable number. It'll be, you know, a few to maybe three with galvanizing, three without, three at different levels of stress level. So it'll be some small number.
And explain the process again in layman's terms.
Well, actually, Marwan, you've been really working hard on that wet test. Why don't you describe
first it? First off, I can assure you when we're done testing them, we'll know damn sure if these bolts are okay or not. And everyone that's not okay, we're going to rip it out. It's as simple as that. The testing program that we're going to do is comprised of four elements. One of them is what Dr. Wahbi called is in situ testing, which is you're actually going to go to every one of those bolts that are on the bridge, and you're going to do the hardness test on them. And basically, we're going to pick a population of that, you know, some percentage of that. And that number is going to be discussed this afternoon, and later this week we'll have that. Second thing you're going to be doing is you're going to be correlating the data of the in situ testing to the laboratory testing. So you're going to be basically saying, if the folks are on the site taking those tests of hardness, what does it really mean related to the lab? So you're going to take some of the samples that are in the in situ and compare them to the laboratory so that you can actually have a framework to understand how all the values that you're doing on site relate to what you did in the laboratory. Then you go into the laboratory, and now that's where the hard work starts effectively, because what you're doing is you're doing a series of destructive tests, much like that bolt that you see there where you actually monotonically increase the load on it until it breaks. That failure takes minutes because it just simply increases the jacking force until it breaks. You do chemical analysis, you do metallurgical analysis, and you do surface evaluation of the actual fracture to understand what it looks like. And basically what you're looking at is a term which Mazen, Dr. Wahbi mentioned. We're looking at something that is tough. Bottom line, what you're looking for is that if a crack, a micro crack, does occur in these bolts, and mind you that it will occur. Actually, right now, just to imagine, those threads that you see right here are effectively small micro cracks, because no matter what, at the surface of that, at the very edge where the wedge is, that's where a micro crack would occur. The key is to make sure that the material itself is not susceptible to hydrogen embrittlement. And that's what we're looking after, to understand if the 2010 are or are not. Now, mind you, there are several ingredients that lead to failure, not only the fact that it's susceptible. Also need to have high stresses on them. So the last test that we will do is to find out what level of stress will make them susceptible. And that's the wet test. And if you want to imagine what it is, it's really taking those bolts and putting them for about, you know, a month under static loading that increases very slowly now. We're not doing it within 1 minute. And what we're doing is we're keeping it there for days, and then after it's okay at that level, we increase it, and we keep it there for days, and we keep doing it like that until we actually can plot the level at which this fracture does occur, and then we'll know for sure from data, exactly like Dr. Maroney said, not opinions, what these bolts that sit on this bridge can carry.
And
I do want to add one more thing. Okay, so in place or in situ, you know, on the bridge itself, we'll do some non-destructive testing. We will take some elements out, and then we'll have to replace those, so we'll sample them, and then we'll machine them down in a variety of ways, and then we'll do similar hardness tests, just like the ones we did out in the field, only in the laboratory, and then at times we'll machine this way, and we'll machine elements that look like this. This is a standard ASTM, it's called a 505 test specimen, and sometimes it's machined out of this side, sometimes it's machined out of the middle, and sometimes it's machined on this side, and we'll actually pull these apart, and we'll keep track of how much it deforms as it takes up more load, and we get strength information. We actually get there's actually another measure called modulus of toughness I like to use along with sharpness. From these, we'll also machine these kinds of tests out. Okay, but one of the values, and these are very fundamental building blocks of information. But to me, what I really I'm very excited about is Mr. Anziano and the POC have supported us in doing full scale testing, where we actually get exactly what Dr. Nadir said, these threads, right? Threads are a geometric notch, where this is almost a perfect piece of steel from the inside. And this is the standard kind of test that most people do. People rarely pull these out, but we've been given the permission to actually pull some of these out and replace them. And we've tested, we already tested four of these already, and we'll be doing more of this. And what I like about the whole package is you get to see how the whole system, the material, the coatings, the threads, everything, how it all works and what its capacities are. So there's a whole a battery of types of tests, and each one of them gives us something invaluable. And we're doing it first, each individual piece, its strengths, its hardness, its toughness, its ductility, its ability to strain, and we get these building blocks. But then when we do the whole thing, then we see now this is how it all goes together. And we have to develop mathematical models to explain this, because there's a lot of variables here. How do these components all combine together? And when we know the little pieces, each term, if you will, in a computer model or a mathematical model, then we see, can we repeat with our calculations how this behaved given these building blocks? These are the clues. And so it's a whole battery of tests.
Okay, so we have time just for a few more questions, about 2 more minutes. Jackson
Vanderbeck on the Chronicle. I didn't see in the metallurgical report, you guys figured out how the hydrogen, if it didn't come in during manufacturing, how it got in. Have you guys detected flaws in the galvanization, that the rainwater could have infiltrated, or do you still not know exactly how the hydrogen got in there?
I need you to help me on that one.
From the metallurgical report, we can't really tell where the hydrogen came from.
I can't hear you.
The hydrogen was in the material itself when it broke. And the reason for that is when these rods were loaded, the failure happened within days. And when you look at the fracture surface under scanning electron microscopy, you can easily see what we call the intergranular, which is the evidence of hydrogen. You can't see hydrogen. So it's an indication that hydrogen was already there. Whether it came from what we call the upquenching of the material, when you galvanize it, you excite the atoms within the material, and hydrogen can move at that point. Or whether it came from the fact that they were exposed to water. Hydrogen was there at the time of loading, and that's why it happened within a short period of time.
So you can't detect any kind of imperfections in the galvanization coating. There's no microscopic measurement that you could see gaps or isolate where the hydrogen might have infiltrated while sitting in the rainwater.
You can't, because at that point they're already fractured. You cannot detect if there is any break in the galvanization.
Tom? One final question. This is an important one only because I know something about pre-stressing. In the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, we learned that when you pre-stress these things, basically crank them down to a very high tension and then pour concrete over them to set them in place. Used to be that they were just locked into place, and then over time, because they continued to shrink, the buildings pulled themselves apart and you had the collapse of the Antioch High School roof and all of that stuff, and many examples of this. How can you, in a short period of time, assure that these stretching cables are not going to continue to retract back to the original shape and basically destroy the bridge some years down the road.
Okay, that's okay.
Sure, go ahead.
Basically, you ask a very good question. In relative term of pre-stressing, this issue is a simple one. You're actually, for all practical purposes, not cantilevering a bridge. You're not designing a rooftop of a structure like the Moscone Center. You're actually pre-stressing a block of concrete. And basically, the pre-stressing itself is, as far as stresses are concerned, all you need to know is that the actual pre-stress is applying a force. So the question you ask is a very good one. What is that force? And if actually relaxation of the pre-stressing or creep in the concrete does take place, how much of that force do you lose? So what we've done in this particular design, we've asked ourselves exactly that question. And just to give you a sense of it, we actually apply a load at the jacking ends, at the bottom of these pre-stressed tendons. We apply 75% of guts, which is really FU, the one that Steve Heminger was talking about. And then because of friction losses and creep and all that elements, we actually calculate that the actual effective load just where the saddle is about 60%. So you kind of lost about 15% of that load just about there. But just to make sure, what we did is we said, okay, what we're going to do is going to do a sensitivity analysis. What if that pre-stress load drops down by 5%? So instead of 60, we went to 55. And then we said, what if it goes down to 50%? What would happen? We found out that this specific design is perfectly insensitive to that. At the end of it, what happens, just like you think, that strand is just sitting there, and it's not going anywhere. All it will do, instead of having this shear key right now, the shear key, the way it was designed to effectively not move at all. But this pre-stress, if it does go down from 60 to 50, all it would do is would make this shear key just basically uplift maybe a millimeter instead of 0.5 millimeters. And for all practical purposes, when the bridge is moving about a meter back and forth, I don't think anybody is going to notice that.
Last question.
That's a really good question.
Dan, one question, please.
Do we know that the feds will agree to the independent study, and will the collar be subjected to the feds' review?
No, we don't. I mean, that's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to come in and look over our shoulders, review our calculations, ask us anything they want to ask. That's our job, to be 100% transparent and open. And, you know, it's a good idea because it's an interstate, too. So, no, I can't guarantee it all.
I mean, have you guys had conversations with them about, you know, are they basically on board with all of this and they only needed a formal request?
Not yet.
Or is this like the first... Has anyone called them and said, hey, are you guys interested?
Okay. Mr. Anziano and top Caltrans management, they have, but...
Okay.
You know,
and it was unclear from the letter whether this was going to be part of it. That's why I was asking.
It's up to...
Yeah, I can get the information for
you. I'd follow the letter.
So were you intending, because in reading the letter, I was unclear whether the saddle is going to be part of this.
I think the real focus is on causation. You know, we taking the right steps to assess causation? Are we taking the right steps moving forward with respect to how we're handling the overall situation? So it's a bit of a high altitude view. It wouldn't surprise me if this winds up being folded into it, if they do say yes. It would be great if they did. I mean, the more people you can get to come on board and say thumbs up, especially with agency like that, the better. It's a good thing.
But it wasn't part of your actual request.
I mean, the letter speaks for itself. So.
Thank you, everyone.